Thank you, Vince. First of all, I know it's my first time here. I know it hasn't been going on that long, but I haven't been here, and I just want you to know there's a certain image of you guys and what you do out here. I don't know if you saw this. I was a guest on Hot Stove, Matt Viscursion, Harold Reynolds. Not exactly the most Sabre-friendly crowd, but they had me on. Perhaps you've seen them on television. They had me on, and at the end, I had no idea this was coming. They showed me, hey, by the way, this is going to be coming up. I want you to be aware of it. So Jeff is working on this now. I want to show you what the image is that you have to live up to now.
Dave Cameron has the, enjoy the cruise. I would recommend.
That's not, of course not. We're going to show you the other clip that we have of the very start. That's it. All right, here you go. Enjoy.
There's a big Sabre conference we know coming up in March, and if the little discussions that you have on a micro level with the Clubhouse Confidential staff are interesting for an hour and a half at a time, I can't imagine what you guys discuss en masse at the Sabre conferences. And they're happening in March. Harold was under the impression that it was a cruise. I don't know how this came up, but Harold thought that perhaps it was the Sabre wave of philosophy is taking over baseball.
There we go.
It leaves from some port in New York on the 7th. There's the captain.
There he is. Captain Shredder.
Kenny.
Captain Shredder.
Navigating through all the difficult waters, people like Mitch Williams and the like. Bob Nyer is doing calculus karaoke. That's in the main showroom. Off in the casino, Dave Cameron's...
of Fangraphs, of course.
Right, Casino War Fangraphs. And then, of course, go to the Robo Whirlpool with the Godfather himself, the great Bill James. So it's the Sabre cruise that leaves at a port near you. On March 7th, at least that's what Harold thought it was.
I feel like, you know, it's like in that there's this classic footage that you like of a boxing fight where a guy wins the fight, but then the mother of the opposing fighter comes out with a shoe and bats him over the head. That's how I feel like.
Right.
I just got the win, but I feel like I got hit in the head with a shoe.
Congratulations.
Okay, okay.
That was I want to go to the war room.
There we go. So my apologies to Bill James. I'm sorry, Bill. I had nothing to do with that, first of all. Let's hear it for the guys on Hot Stove. Can we? Come on. The Sabre wave. They knew this was in Phoenix, by the way, but they never let the facts get in the way of a better story, and so there's a little cruise somewhere here in Phoenix somehow. First of all, I just want to thank a lot of the people in this room, and so many of you that are here already have had such a profound effect on my thinking, and not just my thinking about baseball, but my thinking in general and critical thinking. And my thinking critically really didn't even come from anywhere in my education as much as it did from baseball writing and sabermetric baseball writing. And I tell everyone that I can. So again, for so many people here, I mean, it's such an accomplished audience. It's my pleasure. It's my honor to be here that, for me to be able to give the opening talk for this, for this convention, for this conference, is a great honor and a pleasure for me. And thank you, more than anything else for so many people whose writing that I've watched for the pioneers of critical thinking in baseball and critical thinking in general, and the effects that critical thinking has had, critical thinking in baseball has had on critical thinking in general for that next generation that's now coming up. For everyone that doesn't recognize all that you've done, I would just say thank you to so many people in this room. I often, on Clubhouse Confidential, try to think of what can we do with this show. And for each of the last two seasons, on day one, the title of my essay was Lessons in Winning. What did we just learn? We all watched the season, we watched the playoffs, we watched the World Series. What worked and why? Widen the lens, as I say. Come back, stand back a little bit, see the forest from the trees. And I'll tell you a funny story, and this is not a baseball story, it's a boxing story, because I do boxing as well now for Showtime Sports. I'm watching a few years ago, if you remember, Oscar De La Hoya is fighting Bernard Hopkins. Right? Everybody familiar with Oscar De La Hoya, Bernard Hopkins? One guy knows Oscar De La Hoya and Bernard Hopkins. Thank you. So they're fighting, and if you know the backstory, Oscar De La Hoya is a great boxer. He's the welterweight champ. Bernard Hopkins was aging even then, but he's a bigger guy, and so Oscar was the underdog in the fight. So I'm out watching the fight at Max Kellerman's house. We worked together on Friday Night Fights at the time. So I'm watching it with Max. And for some reason, when you have a pay-per-view night, some people filter in, some people go out. My 14-year-old daughter, Claire, actually said, I want to watch this fight. She liked the Golden Boy. She thought it would be fun. Watch the fights with Daddy and Uncle Max. This will be a blast. So she's the only one. Everyone filters out. We're watching the pay-per-view fight. First couple of rounds, Oscar's, you know, classic boxer, keeping him at bay, fighting very well. He's in the fight. He's winning a couple of rounds. As the fight goes deeper and deeper, Hopkins starts to impose his size and his will upon De La Hoya. And at one point, De La Hoya, who's, again, it's still a competitive fight, reasonably close. I'm looking at my scorecard thinking, hey, round 8, round 9, how is this going to turn out? At one point, De La Hoya throws out a right hand. Hopkins dips in, bang, hits him with a hook right in the midsection. And De La Hoya goes down like he's shot. He's on the ground. He's writhing in pain. And before you can even think, hey, well, are they going to get to 10? Can he get up? Can he get up? He's holding his side, just, you know, writhing in agony. And instantly, Max and I both go, oh, liver shot. Oh, I hit him in the liver. Announcers on the telecast are going, oh, he hit him in the liver. And my daughter, Claire, is there, mouth agape. What happened? What just happened? And we're like, he's not getting up. What happened? What could have happened? What is he doing? And we said, he hit him in the liver, Claire. And she said, well, what does that mean? She goes, well, when you hit a guy in the liver, perfect shot, it kind of paralyzes you. And you go down and you can't get up. And Claire's looking at us and looking at the TV, and she says, well, why don't you just do that? Like, what's all this? And you're doing this, and you're dancing around, and the strategy? Just hit a guy there and put him down. Why don't you just do that? And Max and I, of course, said, well, Claire, you can't. No, we have no reason why you shouldn't just do that. There's no reason you should just, you know, wade in, take shots, wait. As soon as he puts his arm up, bang, hit him in the liver and go, oh, God, I'm sorry. Come on, you get in here and save this guy. Now, of course. So there are all these lessons in winning. Why don't you just do what works? And what really works? Look, we all, we have dreams of going back as general managers where we could exploit our vast, you know, advantages and knowledge. But what have we learned through the years? You know, what have we learned as to where we get these advantages? So with Clubhouse Confidential, again, I build the show for the thinking fan. And I say, hey, we're a sabermetric show, but I everything is eventually going to morph into something very different. It's going to go into a show that is not just about numbers. I mean, you know this, not just about numbers and crunching the numbers, but what works. I think any fan that ever thinks, why is this guy still playing third base? Why don't they call the guy up from AAA? He's thinking like a general manager. So our show, what I've wanted to do with Clubhouse Confidential is look at baseball from a GM's perspective. And I think this is the show of the future on television, on radio, in all sports. Let's hope. Right now, we're on an island. We're it. That's it. No one has done it. I think we're the model for the future. I can't imagine others won't capitalize on this, where you have just the smartest analysts, whether they played the game or not. And some of them, some of the best analysts did play the game and managed as well. Guys I've worked with, Larry Boa, Buck Showalter, brilliant baseball minds. You put them in the room with Joe Sheehan, Dave Cameron, Jonah Carey, you know, Joe Posnanski, you're going to have fascinating conversation. I think that's the show of the future. So rather than look at, you know, things on the show like should you bunt with a man on first and no outs, we try to widen the lens and look for bigger advantages. Where are the bigger advantages? Where is the liver shot in baseball? Where is that shot? And it's amazing with all the technology and the incredible changes in the way we live over the last few years that we are still stuck, very much stuck in the old ways of thinking. We make a slight change here and there, but by and large, we are stuck in the herd. You know, there's a herd mentality. Stay in the herd and you'll be safe. We all feel that way. Not as much the people in this room, of course. These are the critical thinkers. But by and large, people will stick with the herd, make slight changes here or there, but stay with the herd and follow that herd right over the cliff. That will happen. And it's not just baseball. I'll give you a perfect example. I'm at a medical conference in October, and there's a physician there who is railing at the ways that this culture, this food-rich, wealthy nation of ours, basically goes through, you know, food addicted, you know, eating poorly, having a terrible lifestyle that will eventually condemn us to dying by cancer, heart stroke, or heart disease. You know, this inevitability that we all are starting to accept. Well, that's the way you die. And he pointed out, and you'd be interested to know this, that a few generations ago, before the standard American diet took place and got in and took hold of our lives, people lived a very long life, and then at the very end, for a few months, you spent those months dying. And he said, now we still live a long life, but we spend several years dying, you know, in the healthcare system, getting stents put in our heart, getting medication to raise our blood pressure, to lower the blood pressure, to get on blood thinners, all these things. I mean, if you know any old people or any older people here, you have a tray of meds. It's not the way to live. It's not the way we have lived before, but we follow the herd. We've gotten there now, following the herd with this is where we have landed, so this is what we have to accept. And this physician says he's always confronting specialists and other doctors, the ones that, you know, prescribe this medication one after another for all of these patients, these older patients. And he says, you know, why do you do this? You know, why do you do this day after day, just pumping medications into these people when you know it's not going to work? It's just prolonging things, and it's not actually going to save their lives. And he said that they come back to him when they finally get to it. I hope I'm spelling this out correctly. That, you know, he's saying the way to systematically and change your life, the way to avoid this, you know, this inevitability of heart disease, cancer, and stroke is to have a nutrient-dense diet and to eat completely differently and have a healthier lifestyle, that that's the only way out. And he asked doctors that, and they say, well, yeah, of course you're right, but. Yeah, well, no, we know you're right, but. And he says, but what? And so I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, one, I'm changing the way I eat. One, that's one thing. And two, this is just like the MVP debate. To me, it was just like it. What had I been hearing? It was October. And what had I been hearing constantly? Trout versus Cabrera. Well, yeah, we know you're right, but. Yeah, but what? But you choose to live in ignorance, but you choose to live in denial, but you don't want to see evidence or hear evidence or recognize what's happening in front of you. Yeah, but. I'm not telling this group anything it doesn't know. I know you are the innovative thinkers. You're the critical thinkers. You have that. But we all have to fight against that herd mentality. It is difficult. Look, Miguel Cabrera did actually win the MVP award. There is still a yeah, but mentality that's out there that dominates the world that we live in and that we work in. But we are breaking through in this world, and these are kind of the last gasps of that yeah, but generation. The next challenge is for innovative thinking. You know, this is a period of innovation and you know, changing things, and you, at least you would think. In the early days of the game, think about it, things were very fluid. Rules would spring up to stop those who are exploiting the loopholes. Those who are exploiting loopholes are seeking a competitive advantage. And as the game matured and solidified, innovation calcified. On the field, we know now, you know, players, managers, coaches, always looking for a competitive advantage. Strategy, nutrition, exercise regime, performance-enhancing drugs. These are things, people looking for an advantage on the field of play. At an institutional level, though, innovation is still very rare. So here's something to think about and try to think of things innovatively. And what I have found in the last 2 years of doing Clubhouse Confidential, the things that we know, that we can see, right? The liver shot to De La Hoya is right there in front of us if we want it. Who can do it? We know relief pitching ERA is better than starting pitching ERA. This is despite the better talent in the starting pitcher pool. Two, hitter production goes up against a pitcher the second and third time around that they face them. This is, again, by and large. We know pitcher velocity, by and large, is higher when the pitcher pitches in a short burst, like one inning. So why are we still pitching like it's the 1890s? Why don't we do something like this? Why are we ignoring a competitive advantage? And what we found is, I mean, one thing we should learn from baseball history is the entire business will ignore a competitive advantage if that's what the herd is doing. Somebody, somewhere, is going to take advantage of this. Like, why are the Rockies, and I had an interview with Bill Guyvet, the GM of the Rockies, and I found him, like, he was apologizing for doing the innovation that they did last year. Why are they apologizing for it? Shouldn't they be saying, yeah, we did that, and we're going to go further this year? And we know there are repercussions from straying from the herd. You know, if you fail within the accepted norms, the herd understands. When you go off on your own, do something drastically different, then you're basically telling the herd, I know better than you. And we know that there are repercussions from failing outside of the accepted norms of the herd. You might remember Dave Duncan, Tony La Russa starting a rotation with each pitcher only going three innings at a pop, and they eventually scrapped that. You know, did anybody know how long they tried that experiment? A week. You know, it didn't work right away. They were being mocked. The townspeople were, you know, gathering with the torches and the pitchforks and said, "Burn him! Burn him! What is he doing?" And so they had to stop. They went back. And I always believe that Duncan and La Russa basically thought, this is not worth it. Let's just go back. We'll figure out another way. And by the way, this is the I've had these conversations with friends. This is the only industry that I've found. Well, maybe it's the whole sports industry, and maybe this is more pervasive than I think. But it's the only industry that I can think of that where being called a genius is embarrassing. Right? Now, Tony La Russa has fought the genius label for 25 years. Can you imagine a chemist being, you know, say, "Oh, that guy, he won the Nobel Prize. He's a genius," you know? And they would just say, "Well, yeah, he's a genius." With Tony La Russa, you know, he's like, "Genius? No, wait a second. I never said mastermind. No, that's not me." You know, Tony La Russa going home and his wife is there. "What's the matter, honey?" "Oh, they're calling me a genius at work, honey. This is bad. This is really bad." So I would ask, and this is one of my big picture thoughts that I found just, you know, doing this study for the last 2 years. Why hasn't a team gone bullpenning? Why hasn't the team gone in, you know, on a full attack with a full arsenal of pitchers? You know, at the very least in the postseason. We saw a little bit of that with Tim Lincecum and the Giants. They kind of lucked into that. They kind of fell into that, but it worked beautifully. And that's just the start of it. You can imagine if a team, we've seen it in certain games where they go all at you. Maybe the pitcher, the starter, starts two innings, then you go one inning at a time, going at you full throttle, full blast every time out. And you say, "Hey, this is unfair." Yeah, it's unfair. Is anyone interested in an unfair competitive advantage? You know, I guess you got to be careful. You know, you'll be called a genius. You've got to be careful. I'll give you another example. Anybody watch the UFC or MMA? One guy. Yeah, I'm figuring not that many people. In the UFC, they actually put these guys in a cage. They're in a cage, stripped down to their shorts, and they put them in a cage, and they fight. This is mixed martial arts. They actually fight. I mean, even people who like boxing and wrestling find it barbaric. So, and you know what? Even in MMA, even in the UFC, where they say these fights are real, fights are not real. You can't strike to the groin. You can't gouge the eyes. You can't twist fingers. You can't elbow to the head. Now, think about why these rules are there. Why do you think they're there? Do you think they're worried about the health of the fighters? No. Do you think they're worried about the crowd not liking the violence? No. Do they think it's unsportsmanlike? No. The rules are there. Why? Anybody? Why do you think the rules are there? What's that? Right. And these things that they're outlawing are too effective. They're too effective. We can't let you do that. They will end the fight. Right. A real street fight ends like that. It ends fast. It's not entertaining. Marcus of Queensberry rules, by the way, came into that formed boxing. They came into effect because you can only use your hands. That's it. Makes things very difficult. Makes it a little more artistic. Makes it a better sport. So here's my prediction in baseball. There will be a day, I believe, there will be a rule on the books limiting pitching changes because somebody is going to start exploiting that, and it's going to have to be stopped. I believe the all-out pitching attack will just be too much, and people will have to stop it. It's too effective. There's no rule now on that, so why don't teams do it? But I think eventually there will be. I had this conversation with Bill James. Can I just call him Bill with this group here? I always say Bill James this, Bill James that. I can just say Bill. A few weeks back, and I said, why isn't this done? Or why wouldn't there be more innovation in this way with the relief ace, with the starting pitcher? Why even have a starting pitcher? Why are we basing everything on 1890s pitching? And he didn't like the idea, but he brought up Firpo Marbury in the 1924 World Series with the Senators, saying that the Senators pioneered the use of the relief ace. It was an extremely effective weapon. Firpo Marbury pitched very well. It's one of the big reasons why they won the last World Series championship in Washington. And as Bill told it, the Senators, instead of at the end saying, hey, we came up with something that we showed you, we beat you, and we're going to go further, instead they apologized for it, said, well, he was a failed starter, you know, kind of like Lincecum. Well, you know, we don't know if we're going to do this. It just, you know, it's kind of the way things worked out, so we'll just do it that way. So instead of, you know, saying it's a crowning innovation, they backed off and came back to the herd. and they haven't won a World Series since. Not that that's the only reason why. Someday, I think there's going to be rules for to limit pitching changes, and I think the knuckleball will be outlawed, just like the spitball. That could happen. I mean, do you like a guy that can pitch 300 innings up to the age 46? Do you like that? Anybody like that on their team? Anybody? I don't know. Do you want to sit around and wait for R.A. Dickey, the one guy here and there, to come up with it and you know, happenstance that you just got lucky and you wait for it? Or do you think maybe you want to open up an academy and start churning out these guys? I could see it being outlawed. Maybe I'm crazy. I think a knuckleball academy sounds goofy, and I think, you know, when you win a World Series, you might have to apologize for it like the Senators did, and you might have to, you know, risk being called a genius. Uh-oh, don't let that happen. But, you know, you can downplay it, you can accept the genius label, and you can enjoy your World Series rings at your beach house as you have this sort of success. I'm waiting for this to happen. I see these things out there. I think other people do. And I know in the real world, and a lot of you who work for clubs, I know it's not that easy. I know things happen in real time. And yet, when you look back and you look for the competitive advantages, they are there. You know, I know, yeah, in real life, you don't just go for the liver shot. But maybe we should do it a little bit more. Maybe this innovation will come about. And as advanced as we are in so many ways in the industry, there are still these competitive advantages that can be exploited. Again, my thanks to everybody here. I love thinking of these interesting baseball ethical discussions and innovation and learning from the history of the game, and that comes largely from the people who are here who have been doing the writing for the last 25, 35 years. Again, you've paved the way. I'm grateful. I'm happy to be on TV at the very least, leading the charge for the Saber Wave, the SS Saber, and I'm happy to be doing it. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that anybody has on television, my years at ESPN, Clubhouse Confidential, my work at Showtime with Floyd Mayweather now that we're reunited, or anything else. Does anybody have any questions? Yes.
One of the most important factors. So other than the age of the player, what is the most important factor in your view in the analysis that's embedded in the shredder?
All right, now which shredder are we talking about? This is confusing because on Clubhouse Confidential, I do a thing called the shredder.
Right.
And that's just me looking stuff up. Okay. And my researchers and trying to figure out who is this guy, how old is he, what are the factors involved, where is he trending, and all these other things. Now, on Top 10 right now, there's a different thing.
Yeah. Well,
okay, is that what you're talking
really
about?
That's really what I'm getting at.
Okay.
And in connection with analyzing these people and their performance, what's, other than the age, what is the most important factor, analytical factor, relating to a pitcher and the most important one relating to a field player?
Wait, what was the second half of that?
A field player.
Basically, it's just a methodology, and I found it extremely useful. I can't tell you exactly what's in it, because that's our, and it's nothing even proprietary. It's just because we don't want people mixing in and getting obsessed with the math. There's no mystery to it, except we're using all the data that's there. With pitching, we're looking at run prevention, earned runs, unearned runs, base runners per inning, strikeouts, all of these. Anything that we would do if a bunch of us got together, we would try to figure it out. We also try to do the normal aging curves where you would add WAR, subtract WAR, depending on where the player is on that. We just tried to do something that made sense. Now, again, it took some grief, but I will say, it took grief mainly where you wanted to take grief from the mainstream fans saying, "Hey, wait a second, that's not true." Yeah, well, the perception of what you have and the reality of what this player is could be two vastly different things. But every number one player on our top 10 right now was the same player that me and my staff, our researchers, came up with as the number one player at each position. It was exactly the same. So there is something there, and there are certain things that, you know, like how many years back, I'll give you this little tidbit. For position players, we went back 3 years. We wanted to see the last 3 years because anybody could have a lousy year, an injury, something like that. So we went 3 years. With relief pitchers, we went 2 years. We just found it to be better. And, you know, if you see, when we had Bill James on the show himself, and Bill's list is going to be slightly different from the Shredder, would be slightly different from my list. I did my own list prior to the Shredder. I didn't even want to know what Bill thought yet until I did my own list. And you're making judgment call, many more judgment calls than you'd like. So I think where the Shredder was invaluable was it was spitting out the number, and that was the end of it. And you might not like it, but you'd have to deal with it. And we did it honestly, where this is what the numbers say. Cliff Lee was, I don't know, way, way up. It's still in the top five, top four. That's what the numbers were saying. And you're thinking, yeah, but, yeah, but what? Yeah, but nothing. That's actually what the guy is. I hope that explains it a little bit. Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, hi, Brian. John DeWine from Baseball Info Solutions.
And
here you are at at the Sabre Society of American Baseball Research Analytics Conference, and you're talking about boxing and MMA. Now, I love boxing and MMA, but my question to you is baseball or boxing, and be honest.
What's that, for me?
Yeah.
Oh, baseball.
Really?
Oh, yeah, easy. Yeah, easy. Boxing's on weekends, that's it, yeah. Baseball was my first love. Studied it my whole life, and started like getting better informed on it. Probably around 1990, reading Total Baseball, and I was a little late to Hidden Game of Baseball, but within the Total Baseball book, it was there, John Thorne and Pete Palmer, and then reading everything Bill James wrote, and then just following the trends as the internet came up, and asking, well, why? And that's what I do in MMA and boxing too. Well, you think this, but why? That critical thinking, I think, lends itself to all sports. I mean, I had a blast when I was doing my own radio show on ESPN, doing the same sabermetric things to Michael Vick, Randy Moss. You know, I was saying for 2 years, Randy Moss, by the way, is no good. he's done. Look at his performance. And everybody would argue it and say, no, that's not true. And I said, well, the evidence is not telling me that. And where you could actually, it was funny, the end shot of that was, you'd say, where's Randy Moss being drafted in fantasy drafts? Where you're the GM and now your knowledge is tied directly into whether you will win or lose. When people actually have to make that choice, they'll make a choice based on information. And Randy Moss was being drafted, I don't even know where, but he used to be a first round, second round pick. He was at that point in the last few years, even when he had a great reputation, a 13th, 14th round pick. I don't know, I'm making that up, but it's way, way down. So the people that were following the information already knew he was washed up way before the football industrial complex was hip to it. But thank you for asking a question. I was getting a little nervous when you started. I said, here we go. I could be in trouble. Anybody else? Any questions? How about right there?
Oh, okay.
John, by the way, is responsible for the Sabre Wave at ESPN and pushes that greatly. Let's hear for John Walsh just for a second, who's talking about an innovative thinker. Well, you stood up, John.
I know you're always thinking about this. What questions are you asking that you can't find the answers to that we should be finding numbers to get the answers to?
I think in the last 2 years, John, I've found just what a gap there is in defense and finding the right blend and taking the time to try to find it. I think two things. Yeah, one, defense, because basically we would have, I want to see runs saved, I want to see UZR, and I want to know what inside edge is saying. And inside edge, for those who don't know, scout every play. There's a guy at every game, or at least watching video, as far as I know, that is scouting it. Now, I just want to see all three things. Are they telling the same story? I don't know what the best one is, but if hopefully they're telling you a similar story. At shortstop, when we did top 10 right now this year, and I'd said this to Bill James when we had him in, I found conflicting metrics all over the place at shortstop, and that's a problem. So that's the great unknown. Obviously, a greater unknown is at catcher. What's really quantifiable in pitch framing and then even beyond, and we just got to pitch framing. The other part, though, that I thought was most fascinating, in the MVP debate, what I tried to tell all of our ex-players, if I tried to crystallize the thought, was there is a different way we value the game as we watch it unfold in real time. All these small things. A difference between the way we value things when we watch a game in real time and then when the game is over and we've collected the data. And I think I'm parroting something that Bill has written many times. Again, a lot of things I get are just, you know, just Bill wrote it. I believe it. When you're looking at these things and trying to figure out all the nuances and the small things, the little things, the intangibles of the game, what do they really add up to? And that we're getting better at quantifying them. But in the end, as the years progress, and here's the Bill quote, the numbers speak louder. The numbers start to take over. And are we missing things? I know I look at extra bases taken now all the time, and a lot of times it just validates what I thought I knew, and which is what a lot of statistics do. But finding what those little things are, that Chase Utley is great at going from first to third, second to home, that Alan Trammell, when you're doing Hall of Fame analysis, you thought he was a smart base runner. He actually was. That's quantifiable. Are there other things that are not quantifiable? So I think that's the gap. I'm still wrestling with leverage. I'm anti-leverage right now. I wrote the column "Clutch is Nonsense" right after I wrote "The Triple Crown is Nonsense." that got a little play among the readers in Detroit. But I'm kind of anti-clutch, but there's some percentage of it in there where what you do and when you do it, it does actually matter. It did actually happen. And so I'm still wrestling with that, with what you do in a certain inning with guys on base and what you do in an inning where you didn't think at the time the game was on the line. But even as I'm saying that, of course, the game is on the line at all times, so I talk myself out of it. That's really the kind of the unknowns that I see. And I haven't even scratched the surface with, and I think pitch FX and hit FX is going to be something that our player analysts, our ex-player analysts, are going to really dig into more and get into that kind of scouting sort of thing. I'm less interested in that. I think our players, ex-players, will love that, to look at what is happening from a pitch FX level and a hit FX level. I like to, again, stand back, widen the lens. But I'm glad you're here, John. John, by the way, years ago was telling me to go to the MIT Analytics Conference, and ESPN has been a huge supporter of that. I've told my bosses now, we need to jump on this conference where all the smart people are and get involved. But it's great to see you here, John. Thank you. Right there.
Well, first I want to comment on two of your comments before my question. I think the idea of removing the knuckleball would make baseball boring. I think we should have more knuckleballers. I prefer the phrase "you can't predict baseball," and the knuckleball predictable.
Oh yeah, no, I'm saying that it is. Of course, there should teams should have knuckleball academies churning out knuckleballers. Eventually, I could see a place where it'd be so effective they'll just say that's it, no more.
On the other hand, it may just change the way people bat. It may just change the way the hitters respond.
Possibly.
So it's an interesting supposition. I also am impressed with the fact that you see the gap in defense. It's a big deal in the idea of quantifying that. What my question has to do with, though, is everything you're talking about seems to be focusing down to the sort of most efficient way to do something, which is, of course, something you can pull out of analytics or sabermetrics, in a statistical sense. How would you take into account, each team has a lot of individuality. There's things like, there's park effects, there's the long-term contracts, people who I tend to think of as, set players on the board, as it were. There are essentially each team. The idea of making cookie cutter is kind of where it sounds like you would end up going.
Nope.
If you went for, see, this is what I want you to clarify.
Yeah.
Because if you were going for your liver punch or whatever, every team couldn't do the liver punch the same. And so being worried about getting rid of some of these things, I'm wondering how you would address that based on the fact that every team essentially would have to, they have to build their teams differently. The Rockies are going to build differently than San Diego, then are going to build differently from the Yankees.
Yeah.
I think
there's two separate things, if I could, again, to crystallize that thought. There's performance analysis, what happened and how you analyze it. And then if you're with a team, and I think this is the next wave of the future, is performance maximizing, which is what do you have? I did an essay that LinkedIn, Tim Tebow, Jeremy Lin, and I said, what's the lesson in baseball? And I said, what should the Knicks have done? The Knicks should have totally revamped what they had given their personnel. Instead of, I'm totally against, maybe I put this perception out there, I'm totally against that. You should utilize your personnel, maximize your personnel, build around what you have, and use that. The Knicks had Jeremy Lin land in their lap, and they blew it. It made me crazy. And fortunately, I didn't have to talk about basketball at that point, just talking about baseball. But I said, I've got to get this in. And why? And obviously, Tim Tebow is a fascinating study. He's oddly successful in certain instances. How do you maximize those instances? That's the challenge. And then I thought, okay, what's the lesson now in baseball? Like, where's that advantage? What's not there? And I said, it's R.A. Dickey. Now, this was last year, pre-Cy Young year. I said, R.A. Dickey, knuckleball pitching, there's our conditioning and our bias against valuing these guys for no reason except it's what, unmanly? It's a gimmick pitch? It's nonsense. What does it actually do? It actually gets guys out. And that was where I landed on that. The year before, R.A. Dickey did that. I'm not claiming that I did anything. I just looked at it and said, yeah, that's it. So right, where you're going, I'm completely on board. I'm saying if you're a general manager for a specific team, I'd be constantly looking for small advantages and large advantages. And where we think now that, well, the small advantages are and the large advantages are gone. You know, look, the smart guys in every front office now, we can see with who's available every year in free agents, as opposed to even 10 years ago. You know, Billy Beane told me, you know, my loopholes are closed. But you got to think of new loopholes. And I'm just pointing out there are some loopholes there. And the other part is, I think eventually, what you'll get to is who is, you know, actually getting the most out of their talent. It was written about actually in Soccernomics, and I don't want to just, you know, I'm just picking out information. One team in particular really had an entire squad of people, a department, not just one person or not, hey, we're going to take care of you if we sign you, but an entire department devoted to, when a big transfer came in, taking care of that player, making sure his wife knew where the nice apartments were, making sure that the kids got into school, making sure they didn't speak the language, they would learn the language, taking all of that off the pressure to make sure, are you happy? Can you perform at a maximum level? Because they found most of these players that would come in and transfer big money, they'd be busts. And they'd be busts because they were uncomfortable. Their family was uncomfortable. The change was more difficult than they thought. They were ignoring the psychological impact on that player. And one team in particular, I forget which team it was. Does anybody know who I'm talking about? One team, written in Soccernomics years ago, said, we are going to make sure all of our guys are as happy as they possibly can be. And the results were tremendous. I think that's the next wave. And I think we can see that in all of our businesses. How well is the company says, you know, they want you to go through a wall for them. You know, do you think that's worth it? In your mind, are you saying, they're making me happy, I need to do this for them? And that's all across the board. You know, maximizing performance in business, in baseball, it's the same thing. And in baseball, obviously, your performance, it's, you know, you're on a high wire. It's a high wire act. Your confidence is everything. Your happiness is everything. Knowing that you're not worried about where your family is, talking the language, where am I? Do they hate me? Why are they booing me? All these things. You need to make that guy happy. I think that's the next wave. Yes. Oh, right there.
Hi, my name is David Benmoka. I'm a student at Manhattanville College. My background's really in hockey. I played hockey my whole life, played college hockey and all that. And on my plane ride here, a guy looked over to me and he said, you know, I don't understand why there's fighting in hockey. And he's like, it's really brutal, you know, I just don't understand it. He's like, you don't see it in playoffs, you don't see it in the big games. And that reminded me of, you know, why do pitchers hit batters? And and all of this really circled around momentum to me. You know, can momentum be quantified? Can every pitch be quantified? You know, a guy throws a strike. Oh, now the batter's nervous. And in hockey, I know the reason we start fights is one. There's a respect issue right there. You know, if a guy challenges you, it's respectful to challenge back, depending on what the rules are. But it's also to change the momentum of the game, to change the outlook of the game and what could happen. And I think momentum is a process to winning. Winning is a result, and we can always aim for the result. But if we don't have momentum and if we don't have the advantage throughout the game and the belief in our heads that we can win, mm-hmm. I don't think winning is possible.
But let me jump in. If they took fighting away, you'd adjust. You just have to figure something else out. And this came up actually last week, and I did a rogue commissioner on it. And thanks for bringing up hockey, right? I think there's lessons in all sports. And that was a big topic when I was used to do my radio show. I had Barry Melrose and Teddy Atlas on. And it was like, why are we fighting? Teddy Atlas is our boxing commentator for Friday Night Fights. And, you know, why is there still fighting in hockey? And Barry Melrose, of course, you know, ingrained in the culture, the Canadian hockey culture, thought you cannot take this out of the game. I look at it that it's a barbaric last vestige, you know, of a bygone era, like crashing into the catcher. Mike Matheny brought this up last week, and he's a catcher. He's been concussed on the field. And he even said, people say, hey, it's part of the game. I can't see how it makes any sense. And he's right. In, you know, John McGraw and the old Baltimore Orioles used to hold guys by the belt when they tried to take a lead off first base. They would trip you on the bases. That's why they had to put extra umpires out there. They would frequently run up the first base line, step on a first baseman's leg. All of these things to gain a competitive advantage until the powers that be said, okay, this has got to stop. And if you're running hockey, you watch Olympic hockey and you say, this is great. Why do you need fighting? You don't need it. It's just a vestige from a barbaric era. Now that talent is so much more expensive. If you were to appeal to the economic sense of it, to have Buster Posey gone for a full year, you've got to get rid of that. You know, you're having people buy tickets to see the understudy. You don't want to see that. You want to see Buster Posey. You want to see the catchers. I don't blame any GM, any team that says, my catcher, do not block the plate. Don't stand there. And it's an easy fix. You can't block the plate, and you also can't run that guy over. It's basically, you know, everything that happens on these other bases, home plate, now it's the same deal. You tell everybody, and you call guys out if they try to run over the catcher. And we saw in the World Baseball Classic, a guy blocked the plate. I got up, and I told Dave Valley, who's a former Major League catcher, I said, that runner to me is safe. I'd get it right out there, call him safe. Now, until those rules come into play, it doesn't mean that. But, right, that's I think the fighting in hockey is a perfect example. You could just get rid of it, and there'd be new ways to garner respect. You can check a guy as hard as you want, do it cleanly. But, you would want to get rid of that, that part of the game, I would think. Yes?
Brian, you talked about the herd mentality, and I want to ask you a question as it relates to pitching, which is a fascinating subject for me. As I remember, we've had a taste of some of this before. You have the people that are stuck in that herd mentality. And what I'm trying to ask you is, where do you think it's not legit? Where do you think there's a legitimate gap analysis? And here's a framework for you to think about. You have some of those people that getting back to pitching. Where are those days where, you have your starters going 7-8, long innings, and of course we have the folklore of the 16-inning game with Marshall and Spahn to be ended by a Mays home run and all that. Mm-hmm. And we had a taste of innovation before, like the All-Star games and other times when managers like Dick Williams and Earl Weaver once in a while would throw three different pitches in a game and you win a game and say, maybe you don't need a starter. But where do you think legitimately there's a gap analysis? Are we still trying to figure out, whether you're talking about a GM or a fan, about is it the injury part of a pitcher? What pitchers? How far can he go? Is it the mental part of a pitcher? This was discussed in Boston. Where's Daniel Bard's head at? Is he a starter or is he a reliever? And that mental part of how he sees himself is important. Are we still trying to figure out? Big debate today about closers. Mm-hmm. about having a closer just for one inning. Some feel that maybe. Should be more than one inning.
Of course, yeah.
But where do you think, aside from people that are not wanting to, that are not stuck in the herd, but where do you think there's a legitimate gap that we need to think about that's still out there that's legitimate for bait, and where do you think we need to go to try to take it to the next level?
I would think, you strip away everything you think you know and the way you were brought up within the culture and think about it. If I was, if it's late 1800s and I roll into town with my barnstorming nine, right? And, hopefully I've got 20 guys, but we roll into town and we're going to play your team. And I wanted to beat you that day. I would roll into town. I'd have my starter pitch until, and this is very George Earnshaw of me, 1964 percentage baseball. I would pitch my starter until he had to hit. And unless he could hit very well, I'd pinch hit for him. And then I would throw a different pitcher at you basically every inning and then even make changes within the innings to get a platoon advantage. I'd throw everybody at you that I could. And you would say, that's not fair. And you're right. It's not fair. I have a great advantage on you. Now, how does it work? I told Larry Boa, Larry, when we're running a team, we're going to take over. And Larry said, yeah, you're right. We're going to win that first game, BK. What are we going to do in the second game? And I said, Larry, I don't know. So I'm thinking, yeah, you'd have to change the mentality. I mean, you know what the one thing the players all say to me, and Joe McGrain and Dan Plesak and all the guys will say to me, they go, yeah, but now I can't win the game. And when I go in contract time, yes, of course. No, I don't even know where to start. Of course, you need to. I'm paying you for your performance. Wins, saves, holds, meaningless. Your performance, your run prevention. And I would roll in. Now, maybe it would be different. Maybe as, you know, I think Tom Tango wrote, if you have Smoltz, Glavin, and Maddox on your staff, maybe you're not doing that. Maybe you're getting, you know, for your first 2 days or 3 days, you're getting more traditional 5-6 innings. But I don't think I'm ever, again, this is in theory. I know if anybody who's working with a club, I know it's not this easy. But in theory, if you stand back and if your team stinks and you're trying to do things differently, and I applaud the Rockies for trying something, I think I wouldn't have a pitcher, a starting pitcher, face a batter for a third time, really ever. And I would then you would have to figure out how fast could that guy come back? How fast? And I've asked our pitchers this, and it's difficult for them to answer because they just never did it. But it's watching the Cuban team play baseball. They go in to win that game. And I was at a game in 2003, and I brought this up in an essay, 2003 for ESPN. I'm in San Juan watching the Cuban team. I forget who they were even playing. They might have been playing Venezuela. Cuban pitcher, ace of the staff. I think the second inning, third inning, I don't think he's allowed a run. He walks two batters. He's out. He's gone. New pitcher comes in. They prevent those blow-up innings right from the start. Don't allow them to happen. Bruce Bochy in the World Series this year did not allow blow-up innings. The moment there was an inch of danger, bring somebody in. Now he had Tim Lincecum. He kind of lucked into that. But at least he had the flexibility and the knowledge to say, hey, I have a weapon. Use your weapons. So you'd have to figure out, how fast can a pitcher get back? You'd have to tell them, we're not punishing you and we're not going to stop paying you because you're not getting a W. That's gone. You'd have that a revolutionary way of thinking, and you'd have to get your players and you'd have to get your whole organization on board. But I'm thinking somebody eventually is going to do it, and then you know, the counter strategy to that is, and I think Bill mentioned this to me, that, yeah, you'd have to stop it. You know, because Bill said, I don't want to see that type of baseball. And I understand. We like the hero getting out on the mound, and he's your starter, Christy Mathewson, and he's going to pitch until he gives out, until he collapses. I don't see that as a smart way of doing it.
Within that is the rotation mentality, or Holy Grail, as some would say, would have to change as well.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. Why not? The basis of all of this is that when we started this sport, the guy was throwing a little mush ball, and he was just laying it in, and the action was, and I'm borrowing this from my reading of John Thorne and talking to John Thorne, if John's here, I'd like to, give that attribution, was initially the game was at the guy, it would be the batter against all the fielders. That was the action. And then eventually, of course, you're trying to get a competitive advantage. You try to sneak one in there. Now pitchers are throwing harder. They limited. You can't throw you can't throw a pitch from up above your shoulder. Once that rule changed, now you can throw it from up here. Now you can throw hard. Now you can strike guys out. And the game started to evolve as a battle, a one-on-one battle between pitcher and batter. But initially, baseball was a battle between the batter and all of the fielders. And when you think about it, that's kind of an exciting game. I mean, does anybody know the percentage of the three true outcomes now in baseball? How many plays? What's the percentage of plays that don't even involve a fielder? There you go. Of course, I've known this. Yeah, it's 31%, right? Yeah, the three true outcomes right now at an all-time high of 30%. So think about that. Nearly a third of all outcomes on a field don't involve the fielders at all. That might not be the best way to play baseball. I don't think it's gotten to that point where it's crazy. I had this conversation with Dave Cameron on Clubhouse. When you reach the point, or if we ever reach the point where we're at Aroldis Chapman, Craig Kimbrell levels for everybody, then we're talking about, okay, half the time the ball's not even in play. This is not good, and rules will have to be put into play. But I love this mode of thinking, right? I mean, it's kind of crazy, but there are ways you can gain advantages here and there. Maybe one or two more. Last question, I'm being told. How about that?
Okay, well, this is the last one. You're talking about matchups and, bringing in a starter, not letting a pitcher face a batter after, a third time and all that stuff, and, trying to gain advantages in certain matchups. But that tends to make the game a little bit longer How much do you think that will affect the overall entertainment industry of the baseball?
Yeah. Look, if I'm with a team, I don't care. I don't care. Also, I think what Bud Selig in the commissioner's office has found, and they did this survey several years ago, and I feel exactly the same way. When I'm at a game, I'm not looking for the game to end anytime soon. There are other ways to speed up the game, is the final answer. On TV, you know, you're selling a TV show, so you want it faster. There are better ways to doing that. And yes, you know, it's interminable sometimes, pitching changes left and right, and maybe you'll have to when a team really goes bullpenning whole hog. But I'm never bored when La Russa was going and making all of his changes left and right in a tight game. I love the strategy of who's he going to now? Oh, I know where he's going. He's getting this guy. He's getting this guy. I love that part of it. The game's not too slow for me there. And for, again, your paying customer in the seats, it's been found they don't care. And I feel the same way. I always look up, I go, oh, seventh inning already. Oh, that's terrible. I'd like to see more baseball. As a TV show, I think people drop in and out so much now. You know, you find most people don't spend 3 hours watching a game anyway. You drop in and out. Maybe it's time to rethink even that the games are getting too long. I don't know if they are. And if they are, it should probably be up to TV to shrink that, you know, a little bit. The breaks are what's really expanding, you know, the length of the baseball game. Well, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed I'm getting the rap from Vince for a change instead of me rapping Vince. But I enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed the talk. Again, my pleasure to be here. I'll be with you all the next couple of days on some of the panels with Bill James, with Joe Posnanski, with our general managers. Thank you very much.